This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University's athletic director says there's a big obstacle to taking his department up a notch. It's the aging Horton Fieldhouse.
We can't use it for all the practices we need to use it for. It's the wrong surface. It's a great track surface, but it's not a good multi-purpose indoor practice facility.
Larry Lyons talks with GLT's Brian Bloodworth. Discover what's happening to retail jobs in Bloomington Normal. GLT's Ryan Denham reports it's more than simple subtraction. And during GLT's Datebook, find out how a couple of student musicians are helping Puerto Rico recover from hurricane damage. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 22nd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Few industries change as often as retail. The current disruption is e-commerce, with the prospect of Amazon delivery drones seemingly just over the horizon. That means big changes for the people who used to work at the stores we don't visit as much. GLT's Ryan Denham reports on a decline in Bloomington Normal retail jobs and why there's more to the math than simple subtraction.
When a big local retailer like JCPenney or Gordman's closes its doors, it becomes another chapter in the retail apocalypse storyline that predicts the end of brick-and-mortar shopping. For Donna, a 41-year-old from Bloomington, it just means another place she can't look for a job. Donna can't find a job in retail in Bloomington Normal. Big box stores tell her they're not hiring, and if she doesn't time it right, she's up against a flood of younger competition, college students and high schoolers.
It's amazing how You go out one day and the shop is there. You go the next day and the shop is gone. It's just a never-ending battle.
Donna is feeling what the employment data has been showing for months, a decline in local retail jobs. Government data show that Bloomington Normal has lost 500 retail jobs in the past year. The 9,400 retail jobs in November were the lowest of any November since at least 2000. Overall, the local economy actually added jobs in 2017, and the jobless rate is now at 3.9%, pretty low. Nationwide, as the economy added more than 2 million jobs in 2017, the retail trade lost 67,000 jobs. Those job losses have hit women particularly hard, while largely sparing men who work in retail. The conventional wisdom is that retail isn't dying, it's changing. While traditional retail jobs vanish, the thinking goes, Amazon warehouse, package delivery, and other e-commerce jobs are taking their place. Still, for job seekers like Donna, this in-between period is rocky. And she's already tried one smart move, education.
The other frustrating thing is I have an associate's degree in law. I'm a legal assistant, but I did that in 2013. I cannot find a job for that either. They tell me, I get it. I don't have any experience, but, I can't find anybody on the same token to take me in and say, come on, we'll show you the ropes. This is what we're going to do. This is what we expect of you. Give me some kind of experience. And then there you are again. I could go get an internship. But all the college kids took the internships.
Donna's phone is always by her side, waiting for a call from one of many retailers where she's applied or put out feelers. Donna asked GLT not to use her last name to not jeopardize her job search.
It's tough out there. It's a tough economy.
Retail trade makes up 1 in 10 jobs in the Bloomington Normal economy. The real story is that retail hiring is not growing as fast as other industries. That's according to Mike Doherty, a senior economist and policy analyst at the Illinois Farm Bureau, who has studied the Bloomington Normal economy.
I think the interesting part for me about local job growth in Bloomington Normal is how our educational and health services category that the BLS measures has been really the engine pulling up our job numbers over 2017, and rather substantially. And right behind them, the educational health services category is the professional and business services. So that's all your licensed professionals. We've had a rebound there as well.
Doherty notes that retailers expected to hire fewer seasonal workers for the holiday shopping rush. The National Retail Federation said retailers were expected to hire between 500,000 and 550,000 temporary workers workers this holiday season. That's down from last year's 575,000.
Overall, I just say it looks like the kind of pressure is on these stores due to e-commerce to not increase their total staff.
Gary Hunter, an ISU marketing professor and retail expert, says department stores are simply not as popular as they once were. Bloomington's Eastland Mall has seen the closure of big stores like Macy's and JCPenney, though the mall plans to redevelop those sites now. Hunter says those department store closures, coupled with a shift to e-commerce, help explain the loss of traditional retail jobs. He says generally retail jobs have grown and shrunk with the rest of the economy. Now that's changed. He says the government's projected growth rate for all occupations is about 7% between now and 2026. It's only 2% for retail sales.
I don't think it should be a sign of a worry about the economy so much as just a sign of actually a developing economy, a growing economy, as they're just shifting because the taste of people and the way people behave changes. And as it changes, the jobs change too. So it's shifting from being more what we've traditionally thought of as retail into other areas.
The shifting retail landscape is affecting men and women differently, according to a 2017 study from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. The Institute found that women lost 160,000 jobs in retail between October 2016 and 2017, while men actually gained 106,000 jobs during that time.
It was a shock to us.
That's Heidi Hartman, who worked on this study. She says one explanation is that there are different types of retail jobs, and they're faring differently in the age of Amazon. The U.S. shed 90,000 general merchandising jobs in 2017, the retail jobs women are most likely to hold. Meanwhile, building materials and garden supply stores gained 28,000 jobs during 2017, with men benefiting most from that growth.
You know, devastating effects for women. Women often rely on these retail jobs. They're often part-time, which can help them with scheduling family obligations like childcare, school schedules, and all of that. And many women look for nearby retail jobs in the malls and in the stores because it's a short commute from their homes.
Hartman says this is pretty unusual for jobs in any industry, to see men and women faring so dramatically differently.
And I think for women who do disproportionately bear the share of family care, whether it's children or older parents, or other older relatives, or even an older spouse who needs care. Retail is often a go-to job for women, especially.
Rob Carr, president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, is quick to push back on the retail apocalypse storyline. He noted that 2017 holiday sales increased by a better-than-expected 5.5% over 2016.
Retail is the most evolutionary of all the business sectors. It always is changing, and the pace of change is quickening. It's seemingly all the time, primarily due to technology.
Carr says e-commerce is fast growing, but still only represents 1 in 10 total retail sales. He says retailers are figuring out they can't just be brick and mortar or online, they have to be both. And he says the way we count retail jobs needs to adjust to this new reality.
When they look at just retail jobs, that's not the only thing. We need to count transportation and distribution. We need to count technology-type jobs, data-gathering jobs. We need to count HR. There's a lot we need to count in retail that historically maybe we haven't looked at.
Indeed, despite adding jobs overall, Illinois statewide lost 12,000 retail jobs in the past year. The state added 11,000 transportation and warehousing jobs during that same time.
Retail is changing so rapidly that everyone's lost sight of what's going on behind the scenes.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The next update on retail jobs comes Thursday when the Illinois Department of Employment Security releases the latest jobs tallies for December, including the holiday shopping season. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting Push Physical Theater's adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Saturday, February 3rd. Combining acrobatic motion theater and traditional dialogue, it's an innovative take on one of literature's most famous villains. Contains mature content. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is GLT.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, discover how a couple of music students are helping Puerto Rico recover from hurricane damage. The GLT Datebook is on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Athletics isn't all about competition and performance on the field. It's also about facilities. GLT's Brian Bloodworth discusses the needs of the future and the athletics department strategic plan with ISU Athletic Director Larry Lyons. Lyons says football coach Brock Speck and others have been lobbying for an indoor practice facility for a long time.
We started a second phase of long-term planning for all of our athletic facilities about 2.5, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. The plan we had on the books was Redbird Renaissance, and it was about 10 years old. The primary facility that needs that we have revolve around an indoor practice space. Horton Fieldhouse is a wonderful old barn and has served athletics and the campus very well. What most people probably don't realize is in the mornings, Horton Fieldhouse is an academic facility. In the afternoons, typically becomes a practice facility for Illinois State Athletics. And in the evenings, it is a primary recreation facility for campus recreation. We can't use it for all the practices we need to use it for. It's the wrong surface. It's a great track surface, but it's not a good multi-purpose indoor practice facility.
Well, it's got to be 20 years old.
The surface is about 20 years old, and we're going to address that surface here in the next few months. But it doesn't fit the needs, and we don't have the time blocks that we need to have all of our teams practice for about 6 months out of the year. We looked at the functionality of Horton and said we need to address that. That led us to an indoor multi-purpose practice facility, which about half the schools in the Missouri Valley Football Conference have either a domed facility or a self-standing practice facility. And it doesn't need to be grandiose building. It needs to be a practice facility. If we could find the funds to have a 300-meter track, which would certainly help our track programs, 8 lanes on the sprint side, but a 300-meter track almost fits perfectly with 100 yards worth of artificial surface. What that does is gives you 100 yards of artificial surface that's more appropriate for a football training, but also soccer, baseball, softball, conditioning for all of our other sports. And then with the right netting systems, you could have multiple teams practicing at the same time, which is very tough to do in Horton. Horton is a 200-meter track surface, and it's all track surface.
Now, are you talking on the same site as Horton Fieldhouse?
No.
Would you have to expand it? Or
we tried to see how could we make Horton Fieldhouse be that facility. Because of the uniqueness of the structure, where Horton Fieldhouse and Hancock Stadium are essentially one building, and there's no room to widen the building. I mean, we looked at taking out the east stands, the second set of stands there inside of Horton, but there's offices up there. There's some unique challenges to doing that. We looked at, can we lengthen the building, go north and south? That's probably not a building of that age, something that's the right thing to do. We can make Horton, and it will continue to be a very useful, functional building for this campus by changing out the running surface and then upgrading the glass block walls and lights and paint and things like that. And Horton Fieldhouse isn't going anywhere. We need to move north onto the grass football practice field and build a self-standing building there.
And to do that, you obviously have to have the funding. And right. Are you in the process of that?
It's part of our capital campaign the university is under right now. The easiest way for me to explain it is it's not our turn on campus to utilize much university resources. Our turn was Hancock Stadium, the way we've financed that building. But right now there's a major project going on in Bowen Student Center, and there's other priorities on campus. We understand that, so we're going to have to probably do the vast majority of this privately. And that's not an easy thing. But we're trying to get that done. We need to find that champion, that anchor, that lead gift, that will give us the momentum to really push forward.
What's a price tag on a facility that you're looking at?
It's a scalable type building, depending on length and width is the issue. Depending on how much public amenities you put into it, if it's purely a practice facility, not a competition facility, that changes the footprint. you know, for the sake of argument, if we had a $25 million building, we would be in really, really good shape and from a practice facility perspective, but also track competitions and other things because there'd be a lot of public amenities there. Odds are we could probably have some locker rooms added to that facility, that sort of thing. If you scale all that back, obviously the price tag goes down. If it's just purely for practice, you don't need all the amenities that you normally would need if you were having the public in the building.
You're listening to Sound Ideas, and I'm Brian Bloodworth. We're talking with Illinois State Athletics Director Larry Lyons about the plans for different facilities around the ISU athletic campus. Larry, while a practice facility is number one on your wish list, there are other things you'd like to get accomplished as well.
Let's break that into two things. Let's talk about some things that we've been able to finish in the last year or so, some things that are going to happen in the next year, and then we'll talk about some more of the wish list things. We've been very fortunate with some private gifts that we've expanded the practice facility, the Monier Golf Training Center. We added a green bunker complex on the north end of that complex last summer and fall. That'll be fully operational this spring. We did a refresh to the Owen Strength and Conditioning Room downstairs in Redbird Arena. New flooring, new graphics. We upgraded the nutrition bar. We upgraded the equipment, changed the layout of the room so our student athletes are more efficient in their strength and conditioning. We did a really nice refresh to the Horton Pool Complex. We added a liner to the pool itself so that, that pool's, I don't know how old, 40, 50 years old. We were having some leakage in the bowl of the pool, so we added a liner to the pool, added new bleachers, new paint, new graphics, a real nice refresh of that facility. Last spring, right before the softball season started, we opened up new dugouts for softball, and that was something we're going to have to do in a year or two anyway because the NCAA has mandated softball has become a power game. It's not the slap bunt game that it used to be. And dugouts are right in the line of fire on most softball fields because it's just smaller surface, smaller space. So we upgraded the dugouts, dropped them to make them real dugouts. Obviously some security fencing across the front, put restrooms in there for both teams in their dugouts, pushed them away from the field a little bit so our sight lines are a little bit better. So we were able to accomplish that. Things that are happening in the next year or so, we're going to replace the actual playing surface in Hancock Stadium.
Similar surface?
Similar surface. We have a Field Turf brand field now. It'll be very similar to that. And the graphics will change. Colors might change. We haven't quite got to that point yet, but that's on track. Women's basketball locker room is going to get a facelift. We've done men's basketball. We've done volleyball. In Redbird Arena, that's going to happen over the course of the summer. The Redbird Arena training room is going to get a little bit of a facelift. We're going to knock out a wall and consolidate some space that's not that's next to women's basketball that we can put cold tubs in for some rehabilitation and some actual training type things. But then looking forward, we need to finish softball. Now that we've got the dugouts in, we need to come in, upgrade the press box, upgrade the seating. That facility's 20-plus years old, and upgrade that facility to the playing surface is wonderful. Now we have the dugouts. It's a great park. We're going to have to find somebody to help us with that. Study center, which we have done so tremendously well academically. We've had to compete across Main Street academically, and our student-athletes are really competing in the classroom. We tied our GPA record of 3.23. We've done it four straight semesters. Our student-athletes are utilizing those services to a level that the space we have now is not big enough. We're going to need to expand that space, either find space that we can grow into or build new space. All of our Olympic sport locker rooms that are existing in Horton right now, we're refreshing in the arena. We need to refresh those locker spaces. That's as much as it's a nice place for the kids, but it's also a recruiting thing, too. So we need to do that. We have more work out at the golf course. There's bunker projects. There's a refreshing of the golf course. The last time it had a major workover was when DA was back in the early 2000s. It's time to come in and tee boxes and different things out at the golf course that we need to do, fix some drainage issues, those kinds of things.
One other item in the athletic strategic plan includes a building at the tennis courts to provide restrooms and storage. Lyons spoke with GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth. You're listening to Sound Ideas. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Central Illinois residents are not happy with the unfamiliar and bitter cold in recent weeks. Burst water pipes have plagued a lot of people. There is a silver lining, though. IPR's Rich Egger talks with Chris Enroth, a horticulture educator with the University of Illinois Extension.
One of my favorite things to tell people when they say it's so cold outside is to talk about, well, think about all of the bugs that it's killing right now. They can relate to that more, the idea that all those nasty bugs that they deal with in the summertime, there's going to be fewer of them, you know, because we're getting these deep freezes.
And in particular, you're talking about, I guess, invasive pests, such as the Japanese beetle.
Yes. And so when it comes to our native insects, these are insects that are fairly adapted to our climate. You know, they can survive swings to either extreme from hot to cold. And so it really does equal out with our native insects, both the pest insects and the predator insects. But it's these new invasive species that we're bringing into the area, like Japanese beetles, which are from a more milder climate, and they are not as adapted to these swings in cold temperature.
So how long do we need it to stay really cold to kill off some of these invasive pests?
Well, it really depends on a couple different conditions, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news for this cold snap, but it's not quite cold enough, and the biggest thing, though, is that we have a layer of snow on the ground, which acts as this great insulator to the soil, because right now the Japanese beetles, they're in their grub stage, they're living underground, and most of them live in the 4 to 6 inch layer of soil. They can go up to 10 to 11 inches deep, though. We just now hit the freezing mark at 8 inches, at our 8-inch soil depth. And so Japanese beetles can survive freezing temperatures. They can actually supercool. They create this antifreeze in their body, which allows them to survive temperatures up to 19 degrees. There's a little bit of buffering or insulation in the soil, so we say 15 degrees. But it has to get a little bit colder. And it would be ideal if there was no snow on the ground, too, to allow the soils to freeze much deeper.
And does it need to stay cold for a certain amount of time, or will they just start dying off once we reach a certain level?
Once we reach a certain level. So we had those polar vortexes 4 and 5 years ago, I believe, and we get those minus 20 degree air temps, you know, for I think it was a span of 2 to 3 days. That was enough to create significant freezing in the soil to knock back the Japanese beetles for the following summers then. And so if we could get, again, it depends a lot on the conditions, if there's snow cover, wind, how long it does stay cold. But if it can get really cold for a couple days, you know, that will add into the progression of wiping out some of these darn Japanese beetles.
All right. So the snow cover is a bit of a hindrance in that aspect. But is there any type of silver lining to having a snowpack?
The silver lining, I suppose, is we get the sled. I mean, that's fun for the kids and such. But it also does protect some of our soils as well. You know, it's kind of there's two sides of the sword to having bare soil and then having snow cover. The snow cover insulates the soil. It protects our soil from things like erosion and things like that. And it also then, once it melts, it will supply water. It will help recharge some of that soil moisture in our ground, which is something that we need. It was kind of a dry fall this past year. And so if we could get more snowfall, that would be good, and to help recharge some of that soil moisture.
And it's my understanding that very cold weather is also beneficial to farmland?
Yes. So there's a lot of farmers that do practice fall tillage, and they do that in the hopes that we will experience those freeze thaws. Now, a typical Midwest winter, this is not really atypical, what we're experiencing right now. We've just had three mild winters, and so we're kind of not used to this, so we have to kind of acclimate ourselves back to it. But a typical Midwest winter, we have these deep freezes, and then we'll thaw out, and then it'll kind of swing back and forth. And that swinging back and forth, it creates this heaving in the soils, and it breaks up these tilled clods in the fields, which creates a better seed bed for farmers and even gardeners alike that might be doing fall tillage practices.
Chris Enroth is a horticulture educator with the University of Illinois Extension. He talked with IPR's Rich Ager. Enroth says stretches of cold weather also help prevent many types of apple trees from flowering too soon. And he says the cold conditions convince pollinators to remain dormant. He says mild winters can encourage them to emerge and begin foraging when no nectar or pollen is available. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. The 2018 Illinois governor's race could be the most expensive race in modern U.S. history. Kevin McDermott is a political writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He explains why this game of moneyball between two mega-wealthy candidates matters for voters and future elections in Illinois issues. McDermott talks with reporter Mary Hansen about the race.
It's just been the last few cycles that we've begun to see these people who were never involved in politics before suddenly stepping in with big checkbooks.
And of course, that's what we saw in 2014 with Bruce Rauner. Democrats criticized him a lot about his wealth then. Now, Democrats have their own mega-wealthy candidate, J.B. Pritzker. Has that changed the rhetoric in this election cycle compared to the last?
Well, it has taken away one of the core talking points that Democrats had. As you said, one of the knocks against Rauner was this rich guy who's trying to buy an election. Well, now you have an even richer guy on the Democratic side who could be accused of the same thing. And in fact, it's sort of interesting. It's put Rauner in the position where he can come out and try and use the wealth issue. He's actually come out and said, pointed out that not only is Pritzker, you know, this multi-billionaire who actually has a lot more money than Rauner does, but that Pritzker's money was inherited, whereas Rauner's money was self-made. He's a businessman.
That theme has been present in many of Rauner's campaign ads. Here's an example from May.
He made his name leading one of Illinois' most respected businesses, but his first job was cooking burgers. His second, parking cars.
On the other hand, he's facing somebody who has an even bigger checkbook than himself, and nobody knows better than Bruce Rauner how effective that can be, since he did, in fact, spend, you know, almost $30 million to get into office in the first place.
As you mentioned, both Rauner and Pritzker are self-funding their campaigns with millions of dollars. Tell us why that matters.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of concern about that, because this would be the second election in a row, regardless of which of them wins, in which the sitting governor largely got in there by writing checks. And there's kind of two sides to this coin. I mean, they would say they're not beholden to big donors. They're not beholden to PACs. They're not beholden to special interests. There is a certain independence there, and Pritzker in particular has been pushing that as a theme. The other side of that, though, is that you really have you have no accountability if you're a candidate who's heavily funded by labor unions, for example, or heavily funded on the other side by business interests and the Chamber of Commerce. You're kind of part of an ideological, you know, theme there, and that you do have some people to answer to, and those people have substantial membership and substantial portions of the citizenry are labor unions or are, you know, in business, and they want to know that they have some stake in the governor.
What could this mean for future races?
There's this this question of whether you're locking out people from future elections who aren't rich. I mean, you know, you could see a pattern developing where the parties, either party is so intent on not being outspent and on not getting swamped in the money race that basically they're really only going to consider candidates who are millionaires or billionaires. And I think most people would agree that would be pretty dangerous for democracy to say, okay, you know, never mind your positions, never mind your political background. The first thing we need to see is your checkbook, and if it's big enough, then you can run.
Kevin McDermott is a political writer at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He talked with reporter Mary Hansen with Illinois Issues. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Racism, corruption, and failed school funding top the Illinois political news. That's part of the IPR Politics Roundtable moderated by Sean Crawford. There's been a flap in recent days over white supremacist David Duke, noting that Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner refused to label Duke or President Trump racist. Roundtable panelists include education reporter Dusty Rhodes, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, who says Rauner's campaign later walked back some statements.
This is in the context of President Trump's comments about Haiti and some African nations last week that involved Durbin stood by his remarks, even as President Trump was tweeting about him negatively. And so this has been just a topic of conversation in Illinois, perhaps even more than it's been a topic of conversation nationally, which it certainly has been. And as you would expect, the Republican governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, was asked about this. And he seemed to have a set of talking points ready to go. And what he said was, that language has no place in our political conversation. And I think he repeated a version of that phrase three times at least. But the hosts of this, he's on this radio program on WVON in Chicago with a man named Mays Jackson and a former Chicago TV News political reporter, Charles Thomas. And Jackson asks him, but is Trump a racist? Is Trump a racist? And the governor just kind of keeps repeating, this language has no place in our politics. And Charles Thomas chimes in with sort of a softball and says, well, okay, is Trump a racist? You won't say if Trump's a racist. Will you call David Duke a racist? And then the governor doesn't really answer that. And he just says, you know, we have racism in this country. We have to come together. And you know what? Illinois is broken, and kind of pivots the conversation back to his preferred talking points. And this becomes, I think, predictably to anyone who's been in politics for a long time, that the newspaper headline is Governor Rauner won't call David Duke a racist. David Duke's own website picks it up with a photo of a smiling photo of the governor giving a thumbs up. And it's, you know, the quote, David Duke is not a racist. Well, of course, the governor didn't actually say that. But, you know, this certainly doesn't look good to the extent where, as you mentioned, Sean, the Rauner campaign eventually had to come back and say, yes, Governor Rauner does, in fact, believe that David Duke, the former congressman, the former Klan, Ku Klux Klan leader, is in fact a racist.
And Charlie, governors throughout the years, other elected officials, they can say some pretty dumb things at times. They have microphones in front of them at all times. So it's easy once in a while to just have a brain cramp and not be thinking properly. Do you think it's safe to say that that's what happened here, that he just wasn't necessarily prepared, or he wasn't understanding what the question really was about?
Well, yeah, but that's the kind of question that you shouldn't have to do all kinds of preparation on. It's not like being asked, well, what's the capital of Micronesia or something like that? It's a pretty easy question for most people to answer. Of course David Duke is a racist. That's what he's made a career out of. And I don't know if the governor, as you said, maybe had a brain cramp and suddenly didn't remember who David Duke was or what his history is, or if he was perhaps afraid that he might offend someone out there. And I've said on other occasions, if I'm a politician and part of my base has those kinds of reprehensible ideas and beliefs, I don't want them to be in my base. I don't want them to vote for me. Those aren't the kind of people that I would be honored to have supporting me. So as Brian mentioned, this is kind of a softball question. How could he not say, of course he is? And even say to Charles, that's kind of a dumb question, isn't it? Everybody knows that David Duke is a racist. He's built his career on that.
And he has tried to avoid being negative toward Donald Trump, even avoid trying to mention Donald Trump most of the time since Donald Trump's been on the national scene. Bruce Rauner we're talking about. And Brian, I think at this point, maybe that was caught up in it. You think that was part of it, that he just didn't want to get into the whole Trump discussion, so he just tried to brush it all aside?
Absolutely. As you mentioned, we went a year almost where he would not even say the president's name, probably more than a year. And then, you know, at some point last year, somebody actually said, why won't you say his name? And I think he finally did just say it once then. But yeah, he has this sort of programmed response to just try and redirect the conversation away from President Trump any way he possibly can. And I think that this, you know, there's a political strategy behind that, which is Democrats think that they've got a winning issue, particularly in blue states like Illinois, where Hillary Clinton defeated President Trump by double digit percentage points. They think they have a winning issue. If they can try and tie Governor Rauner to President Trump's unpopularity among Democratic voters, then they think that they have a real shot that improves their chances of maybe increasing their legislative majorities and taking over the governor's mansion in this year's elections. Governor Rauner, on the other hand, you know, wants to distance himself from President Trump enough to, you know, try and win some of those independent and maybe, you know, Democratic voters if he possibly can to him, and also to not irritate this significant number of people who are Republicans who still think the president's doing a good job, or at least is their guy. You know, he's the guy we voted for. You got to stick with the Republican president, even if you don't like everything he says. And, you know, you look at the map of Illinois and how it voted in the presidential election, even though it's, you know, we're called a blue state. That's true on the numbers and in the population, but geographically and where a lot of the Republican voters are in central and southern Illinois, that's deep red Trump territory. Well, so I think the governor is being conscious of his base, too.
I do want to jump over to the Democrats in just a moment, because there's some infighting happening there, especially when it comes to the what some people believe is the front runner in the race for governor on the Democratic side. And that involves, of course, a tape that the FBI recorded of a conversation between the former governor, Rod Blagojevich, and J.B. Pritzker. Now, that has provided some fodder for Bruce Rauner. But going back to this whole David Duke controversy, do you see that the governor has basically stepped into something here that allows Democrats something they can run against him in the fall, that they can run, you know, the governor, you know, headlines that say the governor refuses to call David Duke a racist, put it in an ad, and could be quite effective for them?
I suppose they could, although it's kind of intellectually dishonest at this point, because the governor did, you know, or at least his team clarified. So you could say he was slow to call him a racist or something like that. And, you know, I'm sure they will pull out every possible little thing they can think to get him on, you know, that they think will appeal to voters. And likewise, you know, with the governor's unpopularity as, how do I want to phrase it? His unpopularity, as significant as it is, or the degree to which he's unpopular as he is, his strategy is to try and drag down his opponents. And I think that's why we see him attacking J.B. Pritzker on the Democratic side, even though Pritzker still has not won the nomination. We're a couple of months away from that primary.
Well, of course, we mentioned Pritzker. He's getting some heat from people within his own party, including Robert Marshall. He was the person we heard at the very end of the beginning of the program, where he talked about how anybody that's on that tape with Rod Blagojevich is unelectable, as he called it. But Pritzker has a lot of money. He seems to have positioned himself pretty well, at least at this point in the race. However, the governor is buying a lot of time to air what is, I guess, the entire conversation between Pritzker and Rauner, at least what the tape they have of that, and it's going to air on TV. Charlie, have you ever seen anything like that, especially when it comes to we're still in the primary race and we're talking about a Republican running something against a Democrat?
No, to be honest, I can't ever recall it. And it occurs to me, who's going to spend half an hour watching this stuff? And maybe the real intent is to get the folks like ourselves to talk about it, to see stories in the newspaper about it. There was an interesting twist that I saw, a story in the Tribune, where Patty Blagojevich's wife, was complaining that had that tape been released and made public at the time of Blagojevich's trial, he might have been found innocent, because she contended that that tape supported his view that he was just engaging in the usual type of back and forth political what-ifs and chit-chat, and there was no attempt to be corrupting anyone, and that that tape supported his position, which I found an interesting take on the whole thing.
And Brian, do you think that it hurts, maybe it hurts Pritzker in some ways, it ties him to Blagojevich, but maybe it helps Blagojevich a bit to have this out there?
I mean, yeah, I don't know that it. I mean, Blagojevich has a legal case now. I think he is still, you know, trying to make some last-ditch appeals. I don't know that it. I doubt it really, you know, that the judges have not been very impressed with all of his arguments since his conviction. You know, the judges who have their fate in his hands. Does it hurt Blagojevich? I mean, to the extent that, does it hurt Pritzker? To the extent that you can keep saying their names in the same breath, then yes, I don't think that's good for him. If people actually do take the time to listen to the tape, it doesn't sound good. I guess in retrospect, Pritzker would probably wish he would have said, "Why, this is completely nothing I want to be involved in. Good day, sir," and slammed down the phone immediately. But, you know, if you actually listen to what he says, this is kind of horse trading. And, you know, Pritzker now says, well, we didn't know what Blagojevich was doing at the time. I think that, you know, as anybody who wants to go back and listen to the State Week in Review archives from around that, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, will hear Charlie and other members of the program, this is before my time, but talking about plenty of allegations of impropriety surrounding Governor Blagojevich, even though he was not, you know, had not yet been arrested. So I don't know that that argument holds much water. But on the other hand, Pritzker, you know, was not charged. He does not sound like he's doing anything illegal. He's talking about, as you said, as Paddy Blagojevich said, he's talking about horse trading. And in fact, when Governor Blagojevich tries to steer the conversation toward campaign contributions, Pritzker says something, I'm just paraphrasing here, but he says something along the lines of, we can't talk about that now. We can't talk, presumably meaning in this context of an appointment and then also talking about campaign contributions. So, I mean, if people actually take the time to, you know, analyze this tape and listen to this infomercial, which, as Charlie pointed out, the Tribune reported is going to be airing between 10 a.m. and noon on a handful of TV stations across the state for the princely sum of $11,900. So you know that it's not necessarily going to be preempting the football playoffs or anything like that. You know, if people actually parse it, maybe they'll come away thinking, well, that's not as bad as I expected. But I'm sure that we're going to continue to hear more about it.
Well, let's switch gears here and talk a little bit about education funding. And Dusty Rhodes has joined us. And Dusty, you've been covering education. You covered all of this fight over school funding last year. I thought we were done with this for a little while.
You and me both.
And here we're right back in it. What, as of right now, when it comes to that law that was passed over the summer, where do things stand right now?
Why do you have to ask me such a hard question? We thought we knew. We thought that it was done. And there was a trailer bill requested by the State Board of Education to clean up some technical language having to do with tax abatement places because they wanted to make sure the language in the bill matched the spreadsheets that the lawmakers used when they voted on this. And that trailer bill passed unanimously in the House, 11 votes against it in the Senate. And then at the very last possible minute, the governor has vetoed it. He's issued an amendatory veto that actually has nothing to do with the technical language. It has to do with trying to expand the tax credit program for private school tuition scholarships.
So let me ask this, because a lot of times when legislation's passed and trailer legislation, as it's called, comes along, it doesn't necessarily mean that the original law is null and void. It's in place. So all of this change to get money to these poorer districts and redistribute some of this money, is that still going to happen even if nothing is done with this trailer bill that is in a bit of limbo right now?
It would still happen, but it would be, so that's $350 million. So remember, I always said that this school funding thing was like a big cake. And the most of the cake is your base funding minimum. It's what you've always gotten. It's what you got in FY17. Okay, so this equity part, the thing that's supposed to address the real problem in Illinois, it's just, that's less of the money. It's just the icing on the cake. And that's what's being parceled out on this equitable basis to the neediest schools. They're still going to hand that money out no matter what happens, but it won't go to the neediest schools if they don't pass the trailer bill. So it's like a balloon. You squeeze one part of it, the other part of the balloon gets bigger. So not only would the neediest schools not get it, but other schools would get more. The biggest loser would be Chicago Public Schools. And the Senate Republicans kind of pushed back when I tweeted that their impulse to kill this bill might have more to do with Chicago Public Schools than private schools. But they put out a release And that, you know, they didn't mention private schools. They put out some spreadsheets, and if you get to the end of the spreadsheets, it shows you how much Chicago would gain with this bill.
Charlie, this is this seems like this could have been handled differently from the governor's standpoint.
Yeah, he could have been more actively engaged in the time that they were drafting the bill. If they discovered that there were some technical errors, the trailer passed, he could have just signed the thing. Or if he was going to use an amendatory veto, he could have done it much quicker and not waited until the last minute. And so there is the suspicion that, as Dusty suggested, maybe behind all this is his typical antipathy towards the schools in Chicago, which I personally believe is largely because of the Chicago's teachers' unions.
Charlie Wheeler is the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Other members of the IPR Politics Roundtable include IPR's Brian Mackey, Dusty Rhodes, and Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Local students are showcasing their musical skills in an effort to help hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of GLT's Datebook.
When Hurricanes Irma and Maria devastated Puerto Rico in the fall, some people got mad, and some people got busy. Normal Community High School juniors Kiki Harden and Annabelle Chinsky were inspired to help out, working with Illinois State University Latin American Studies professor Mara Tora-Morn. The pair have organized a benefit concert for hurricane relief for Puerto Rico. It's coming up Monday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Normal Theater. It all began as a community project assignment for their sociology class, taught by Stephen Robinson. Tora-Morn says she was pleased to be involved.
I was delighted that Annabelle and Kiki came up with the idea of doing a benefit concert, because this, for me, exemplifies one of the principal core values of ISU, and that is the value of civic engagement. And so this is really taking civic engagement to sort of new levels in the community.
Okay, so Annabelle, tell me about the scheduling the concert and who you were going to program. How did you go about doing that?
A lot of our friends are super talented with music, and we recently had a Battle of the Bands when this first started, so we decided
At the high school?
Yeah. That was just like a sort of everyone got together to see their peers perform. And so we invited our friend Abby Kimball, and she's a solo artist who's writing her own music now and has been in contact with someone who could, like, get her further into the music industry. And our other group of friends,
they're called Take 27.
Are there 27 of them?
Unfortunately, no. It is three girls, Emma Williams, Emma Larson, and Tristan Bixby. And they're going to perform. They're all very, very talented. And we also have our two a cappella groups from our school, Voicemail and Key of She.
So how much do you guys hope to raise with this event?
I think anything will help, truly.
Maura, you were just back in Puerto Rico over the holidays. Can you tell us about what it's like there right now?
It is really very hard to see what now constitutes the new normal. I am from the west coast of the island. The landscape that we encountered was somewhat similar to what we left a year ago, but you could really see the difference. The roads, in terms of the people, in terms of the traffic, and of course in San Juan, you could really see a qualitative difference between what we were experiencing in the west coast of the island and San Juan. There's still traffic lights that are not working. There's still people who still didn't have electricity and water. So the conditions in the island are still very, very serious.
What's the mood like?
It's very edgy. You see that people are tense. You see that there's frustrations. But when I talk to some of the people, there's a new consciousness that is really emerging in Puerto Rico that I find very intriguing. And I think people are really looking for ways to bring resolution to the problems that they're facing. And in fact, that's one of the things that people frequently talked about, how quickly the collective community came together, and communities really came together to provide services for themselves, for their families.
Well, Kiki and Annabelle, tell me about the lessons you've learned so far putting this kind of an event together.
I've learned a lot of responsibility, having to contact the groups and a lot of planning and things.
We're both pretty shy people, yeah. So this is something that's going to hopefully expand confidence and like show that even though we're kind of looked at as kids, that we can still put something to help society.
I love working with Kiki and Annabelle because one of the things that they showed, they just stated that they're very shy, but they were not really shy in engaging ideas when we were first talking about this. And I think they were also sort of very mature in terms of understanding what it will require to put a concert like this together. So, you know, these are really talented high school students that I dream of having in my classroom here at ISU, because they exemplify the level of civic engagement, the level of connection and vision to see a problem, to find a temporary solution, but also learn as much through the process and through the experience.
That's ISU Professor Maura Tora-Morn, along with Normal Community High School juniors Kiki Harden and Annabelle Chinsky. The benefit concert for hurricane relief for Puerto Rico is Monday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. That'll be at the Normal Theater. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Both Annabelle and Kiki are following in the footsteps of J-Lo, who enlisted Mark Anthony, Demi Lovato, Ricky Martin, and more to hold their own benefit concert for Puerto Rico just 3 months ago. You can find past episodes of the GLT Datebook at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full episode podcast of Sound Ideas, along with the individual stories and interviews today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, Brian Bloodworth, and Charlie Schlenker. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.